Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. I want to jump right in this morning with some breaking news. It looks like the United States may be on the verge of full diplomatic relations with Cuba for the first time in like 60 years. President Obama is going to make a statement at noon, and I want to open up the phones right now for Cuban Americans in our listening area to call in with your first reactions. I'll give you what details we have. But Cuban Americans are going to get first priority on the phone for the first few minutes today. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Is your community ready for this? Do you think the country should be ready for this? Should the world be ready for this? Here's the AP release, the AP dispatch that came in a few minutes ago. American officials say the U.S. and Cuba will start talks to normalize full diplomatic relations. So they haven't done it, but it's start talks to normalize full diplomatic relations. That's huge, and I don't think there's been anything like this since the 1950s. As part of the most significant shift, it says, in U.S. policy toward the communist island in decades. Officials say the U.S. is also looking to open an embassy in Havana. Imagine that. In the coming months. The moves are part of an agreement between the U.S. and Cuba that also includes the release of American Alan Gross and three Cubans jailed in Florida for spying. Now, it does add one statement from Senator Marco Rubio, who, of course, is a Cuban-American Republican senator from Florida. It doesn't have him endorsing it or not endorsing it. It says that that Marco Rubio says the agreement includes normalizing banking and trade ties with Cuba. So how about this, folks? Something that was one of the hearts of Cold War policy in the United States, no relations with Cuba. Of course, there was the Bay of Pigs invasion in the early 1960s under President Kennedy. That was such a disaster. Pressure on Cuba and it being also at the heart of sort of human rights policy of the United States, that if we supported this dictator that had very limited human rights in his country, Fidel Castro, then we would be sending the wrong message to the world. So Cuban Americans, how do you feel about this apparent being on the verge of normalizing relations, full diplomatic relations with Cuba, opening an embassy there in the next few months? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and Javier in Middlesex. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Javier. Are you just hearing the news from me for the first time?
Yes, actually, I was quite surprised, and I very quickly dialed the phone when you suggested the Cubans start to call in.
What do you think? And what's your family background?
My family came on the Mariel boat lift in the 80s.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I was born here afterwards.
Right. So are you happy, sad, confused, mixed? What's your reaction to this?
I'm excited. I think it's wonderful that they're finally starting to open up a dialogue. And I think that this is the right track. You know, not what they've been doing before, kind of just, you know, shutting everybody out, There's been a lot of people in Miami in the exile community that have been working towards this for a very long time. So I'm sure I'm going to get a few excited phone calls within the next couple of hours.
But the exile community also has been staunchly opposed to this, or aspects of the exile community, because, you know, they feel that Castro and now Raul Castro repress the people there, that they're against the freedom, that the exiles who came to this country, especially the early exiles in you know, the 1960 or so period, came here to flee that. The people still there are still stuck with that kind of system, and this kind of lets them go about their business of political repression. What do you think you'll hear that from some of your exile friends, and what do you think about the people who might say that?
I definitely will hear that, and that's going to be a big part of this whole discussion coming up in my family for sure. But, you know, that's more the older generation. The younger generation has, you know, been, you know, more to the tune of, you know, let's let's try and get past that and, you know, get back to our homeland and just, you know, see our families and just make things better.
Javier, thank you very much for calling in. And if this is a happy day for you, congratulations. And Amanda in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, good morning, Brian.
Are you Cuban American?
I am the daughter of Cuban immigrants who have been in this country since the early 60s. And we go to Cuba often. We have a lot of family there. And I'm frankly pretty emotional. This is the way to go, Brian. Isolation has not worked. And engagement is kind of the way of the future. My family in Cuba will also greatly receive this news as they're tired of the isolation and they want more cultural exchange between the two countries.
How about the question of human rights, Amanda?
I think there's work to do there, Brian. But I think when we have engagement versus isolation, we can also make more headway on human rights as well.
Amanda, thank you very much. I appreciate you calling in. And all right, we're going to leave that there as a little marker for the moment, our first two Cuban-American callers. And we're going to come back to this a little later in the program in much greater detail. This just broke before we went on the air. And again, if you're just joining us, President Obama is going to announce at noon today the exploration with Cuban officials of full diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba, including the opening of a U.S. embassy in Havana in the next few months. We are gathering experts and people to react. Obviously, this was a bulwark of Cold War policy. The United States did not want to support communism in any way. Cuba was once used as a military base in conjunction with the Soviet Union at the height of nuclear weapons tensions in the Cold War in the early 1960s. But this policy lingered for all these decades on the part of the United States, even while we supported other dictators in the Middle East and elsewhere, I might say. But there's still the question of human rights and the fact that there's a Cuban exile community in this country, the older generation of which, especially, as our first caller said, might be staunchly opposed to this as somehow being soft on the oppression that remains in Cuba. So we will come back to this. We're lining up guests. We'll do coverage in a little while as soon as we get some people ready to go. But President Obama is going to announce at noon full diplomatic relation talks with Cuba. I want to turn the page, however, to a call in for Pakistanis in the New York area now with your take on the Taliban terrorism problem. And we will also make this a call in for Muslims. These Taliban attackers who launched that awful, awful terrorist attack on a school yesterday say they are killing children in the name of Islam. So Muslim listeners, what would you like to say back to them about that? 212-433-WNYC. The death toll in the school massacre in Peshawar rose overnight to 148, and the vast majority of the dead are children. It's an attack so brutal that even other militant groups, including the Afghanistan Taliban, have distanced themselves from the shooting. Somewhere between 4 and 9 heavily armed militants rushed into the school, we're told, shooting indiscriminately and flinging grenades. The Prime Minister of Pakistan has lifted a moratorium on the death penalty today, and funerals of the dead have already begun. By the way, for those of you interested, there's a vigil at 8 o'clock tonight in Brooklyn, in Midwood. It's at 1090 Coney Island Avenue in Midwood. And Pakistan's Consul General will be there. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams will be there. But any Pakistani immigrant or Pakistani Americans listening, help us report this story. 212-433-WNYC. Call in and tell us if you know anyone involved. Maybe you're a friend or relative of one of the victims. Maybe you're a friend or relative of one of the attackers. What can you add to the story? 212-433-WNYC. Or even if you don't know anyone personally, Pakistani immigrants, explain to the rest of the audience anything you think they should know about what happened in yesterday's attack and what the context for it is. For people who are completely mystified by how any group could attack and kill over 100 children at school on purpose, how do you understand it as a Pakistani, as a Pakistani-American? 212-433-WNYC. Where does this extremism come from? Where does this war come from? What did the U.S. or the Pakistani government do to enable this, if anything? Where does the U.S. fit in, if anywhere? Does Pakistan's status as one of only two religiously defined countries in the world, the other one is Israel, contribute to religious extremism? Do you think it does? And how do you feel just seeing these reports of the sickening attack on kids in the name of revenge against the military and in the name of setting up a more pure Islamic state? Any Pakistanis, any Muslims, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, we're joined by Shamim Berney Abbas, Associate Professor of Political Science and Gender Studies at SUNY Purchase, and author of the book Pakistan's Blasphemy Laws, From Islamic Empires to the Taliban. Shamim Berney Abbas, thank you for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, I'm glad to be here with you, Brian, today on a very important issue. And thank you for inviting me.
Jahangir Khattak, Senior Editor of Voices of New York at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, publishing Voices of the Pakistani Community. Thank you for joining us, Jahangir. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Brian, for having me on your show.
And Jahangir, I gather you are from Peshawar and still have family there. Did you know this Army public school? Can you give us some background on it?
Yes, Brian. Peshawar is now a pretty large city. It has more than 3 million population. And the school is located in the cantonment area, which is like where all the main military establishments are and installations are. And the school itself is not, I think, more than 2 miles away from the corps commander's home, where the military commander for the entire region lives. That's his official residence. And it is also less than 2 miles away from the governor's house and the chief minister's secretariat. So it was very close to the seat of governance of the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. The school has, at the back of it, from a rural area, and the terrorists used that route to enter the school by scaling the wall using a ladder. Because there are fields behind that wall, so they came in a van and they first torched the van, destroyed it, and then they came along with heavy weapons and scaled the wall using a ladder and came inside and went straight to the main auditorium, where there was a class event was going on, and there were a lot of students there, and that's where they first started firing and killing a lot of students. And after that, they started going from class to class and spraying bullets. In one of the instances, a teacher tried to resist them, so they put some oil on him and then set him on fire and burned him in front of the class. So it was like a barbarity of unimaginable proportions. Pakistan has never seen such act of terrorism in its history. More than 50,000 Pakistanis have lost their lives during the past more than a decade of the Taliban militancy.
Yes.
But this was the one which was the most horrific, and it killed so many young students. More than close to 140 young kids were sprayed with bullets and killed mercilessly.
So, Shamim Abbas, this attack on yet another school, the worst, as Jahangir describes it, but
yeah.
It's yet another school, and it's been described as part of a continuing war on education. The Pakistani Taliban has bombed or burned over 1,000 schools, according to the New York Times count.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everybody remembers now Malala Yousafzai,
mm-hmm.
for being an advocate for girls' rights to education and defying the Taliban
mm-hmm.
there and winning the Nobel Peace Prize for it. At the same time, a Taliban spokesman said the attack is retaliation for a military operation by the Pakistani government in North Waziristan. So I wonder how you see this attack. Is it military retribution, or is it part of the Taliban's assault on education in general, or maybe both?
It's both. thoughts, Brian. I'm very saddened to see the photographs, and it's really heartbreaking to see the photographs of the carnage that was committed here in this school. But, you know, I'm not surprised. It was only a question of time. And believe me, there's an Army public school near where I used to live in Rawalpindi cantonment, and there are these Army public schools in almost every cantonment in Pakistan, say in Karachi and Lahore. And there was a big Army public school near my house, and this was in 2007, you know, when the Red Mosque civil war between the military and the clerics was taking place. And soon after that, the Taliban started attacking security personnel in Islamabad and all over the country, and mainly the officer class. They were the targets of Taliban attacks. And a number of times, whenever I drove by this school, I used to think to myself, God forbid if something was to happen here. Intuitively, I had a sense that something may happen here, and I would be afraid to send, you know, my children to a place like this. So I do not see this attack in isolation. It has a whole context to it. There is the whole context of the Taliban-military relationship, which is very duplicitous. Sometimes, you know, they're friends, sometimes they're not friends. And this goes back, you know, to the different alliances and agreements that the Pakistani military has made with the Taliban in Waziristan, and then it led to the killing of Naik Muhammad, Baitullah Masood, Hakimullah Masood, and, you know, all these things. It has a very broad context. I would say it is mainly the relationship, the military-Taliban relationship, and secondarily, it's an attack on education. I see this as a kind of a class war also. It's a resentment against the officer class, you know, who are able to send their children to these elite schools where they get this elite education. And the Taliban children don't have access to this kind of education. So, and then, you know, it's not a short-term thing. It has not happened in isolation. Mm-hmm. This is how I am looking at it. But believe you me, I'm not surprised. And God forbid, you know, there are going to be more such attacks on institutions like these, especially the institutions that are run by the military.
Well, thank
you. This is how I'm looking at it.
Thank you for all that context. And let's take a caller. Kaisar in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thank you very much for calling in.
Yes, hi. While I was on the hold, I had the pleasure of listening to your analyst, how she described the entire scenario in Pakistan and what else transpired and what's the history behind. My perspective is a little different than your author and your expert who's on the show commenting about it. Me being born about a quarter mile away from that particular school, have a different perspective and coexisting in that society with Taliban, who claim to be, whatever you want to call them, animals, butchers, killers. They have many names and many faces, and they commit many atrocities. But there's one thing which everybody needs to understand. Maybe me or there's some of friends of mine who still stay in contact, we have a different take on that. This is not a religious or a class envy statement or a statement from Taliban to teach everybody or tell anybody that what's being done to them and they are retaliating. This is a politically motivated assault at the heart and the nerves of parents and communities of Peshawar and also all those tribal leaders who sit in peace with Taliban in the northern frontier areas, Momans, Khataks, Pakhtuns, all these guys who give them carte blanche to go across and come back to the border. Children, their family, friends, they all go to those schools. And again, I disagree with your expert when she mentioned those schools are for elitists or people who can only afford them. I almost went into that school. Those schools are for people who want to give their children better education, and Army is more than welcome to invite them based upon their credential or qualification.
So can I ask you, Kaisar, what do you think the motivation is? If it's not class, if it's not religion, if it's not being against the military, what do you think is at the heart of it?
The heart of that is utilizing now the tribal leaders, the tribes, all the tribes, getting their efforts, getting their resources. Since there's a drawdown of Americans from Afghanistan, they need assets there who will hunt down the Taliban and literally wipe them out. This was sadly a sacrifice given to the gods to put army and put all those tribal leaders mm-hmm. in sync to enlighten or to bring about one unique enemy.
And Kaisar, I'm going to get some reaction to you now. And Shamim, I'm going to go right back to you because I think he was reacting primarily to what you had just been saying. What do you think about Kaisar's analysis?
Frankly speaking, Brian, I'm not aware of the situation with the tribal leaders. I'm sure, you know, this can be added to the wider context, you know, that, you know, perhaps the Taliban also want to kind of, you know, bring attention to this issue and, you know, to make their presence known. So this could perhaps be added to the larger context, which, you know, frankly speaking, I'm not very mm-hmm. familiar with. And Kaisa might have a point there.
All right. Let me go to another caller, Amar in Woodbridge on WNYC. Hi, Amar.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I don't understand how is this. I mean, it's been going on for I don't know how long in Pakistan, and the people they just keep, you know, taking this kind of nonsense from the government, and they're not doing anything about it. The government, it's a failure of the government, the army, and the leadership, whoever is there, and the people, they have to stand up to it and reject all this nonsense. In Islam, there is no such thing, killing any innocent person. You kill one innocent, it's like you kill the whole humanity. And I am heartbroken to hear this news.
Thank you very much for your call. And so, Jahangir Khattak from Voices of New York at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism and from that area of Pakistan as you were describing before, you know, certainly Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, never said go into schools and kill children. So do you hear voices like Amar's rising up all over the Muslim world in opposition to this attack and saying, you know, how barbarous and this not in my name, not in the name of my religion, thank you.
Absolutely, Brian. You know, I have lived in that city my whole life. I started journalism from a newspaper in that city. And I was also press club president of Peshawar Press Club, which is the largest in northwestern Pakistan. And I know that how that city has seen militancy, how that city has seen terrorism, whether it was during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan or after the Soviets left. In terms of the people looking at it, I think everybody is looking at it as the most despicable act. All the Muslims, and especially those who are living in Pakistan, I think are unanimous in their opinion that it is something that does not reflect on my religion or whatever I practice, because this is something not even close to religion. It is just abuse of religion. If somebody uses one image that may have some religious connotations, it does not mean that that is something that is coming out of that religion. So that's number one. And secondly, for the first time, I think every time such things happen in Pakistan, and these have happened quite often, unfortunately, the Pakistani political leadership and the Pakistani nation usually react in the way that they have right now. But this time, I think the outpouring of support and anger is more than what we have seen in the past, because of the very young lives which were lost. Any life, whether it is young or old, is very precious, and it is a crime against humanity. Anybody who spilled the blood like that is like a terrorist. But the thing is that this time around, situation is different. And it is coming because the Taliban are saying that it is in retaliation to the military operation. So the motivation, of course, is coming from the military operation. That's number one. Secondly, it is happening if you look at it, it's a soft target. Even in Pashtun society, which is the majority ethnic group that lives in that part of Pakistan, their own traditions don't allow, attacks on women or children. That has been their tradition. They have those feuds, family feuds, very common, but they never target their own enemies, children or wives. But they are deliberately targeted. Now, it reflects on like two realities. One is that the Pakistan military's operation, which I think has come really, really late, and it has so far killed more than 1,500 Taliban. So it has definitely damaged their capacity to stage major attacks on the military installations. And they selected a soft target so that they can raise further scare and diminish the support for the military operation. That's number one. And at the same time, it also shows Pakistani governments and security establishments spectacular failure to stop such attacks. Like, I am amazed that I know, I'm very familiar with that area, that when you are entering the cantonment, you have to pass through so many security checkpoints. And if you look at these Taliban or the attackers, the photos of the dead have been on the social media. And if you look at them, so when you look at them, their even facial features and the way they look like, the way they dress, look like they were pretty not normal human beings. So I fail to understand that how a van loaded with all sorts of weapons and explosives can enter the highly secured cantonment area.
Yes.
Such a sensitive area, go there and stage such a spectacular attack.
So
I think it's again an intelligence failure, a security failure, and of course the motivation is coming from what's happening in Fatah.
And so, Shamim Abbas, a last word from you. Mm-hmm. He talks about the intelligence failure, the security failure, and he also referred to kind of the double game. There's also a editorial in the New York Times today that says, wedded to an outmoded vision of India as the mortal enemy, the Pakistani army has long played a double game, taking American aid while supporting and exploiting various Taliban groups as a hedge against India and Pakistan, and ignoring the peril that the militants have come to pose to Pakistan itself. So how much culpability do you think the Pakistani government has, and might this change anything?
Absolutely. I agree, Brian, with the New York Times analysis of the situation. And I spoke earlier about also this thing, the duplicitous game that the Pakistani military has played all along,
yes,
you know, in taking American aid and also, you know, teaming up with different Taliban groups. But before that, you know, let me go back to what Ammar said about the public outcry against something like this, and I have maintained for a very long time, and this is what I'm asserting in my book also, that it's the Pakistani citizens that have to rise up against not only the military, but also the politicians. Everybody's been, you know, playing a duplicitous game, and they're not calling a spade a spade. And unless the citizenry come out and make the government also accountable, the politicians accountable throughout the country. And the only party in the country that, you know, that has been kind of secular in its approach is the Pakistan People's Party. I mean, I'm no admirer of the Pakistan People's Party, but they are the ones that have paid the price in terms of standing up to this kind of orthodox nonsense. You know, Benazir died because of that. Governor Salman Taseer was assassinated, Minister Shahbaz Bhatti was assassinated. If anybody has stood up or, you know, tried to do something about this nonsense in terms of the laws, the so-called Sharia laws that were brought about by General Ziaul Haq, it is the Pakistan People's Party that have, you know, spoken about it. And I think, you know, rather than depend on the politicians, I think it's What's the big deal about, you know, declaring a three-day mourning period? Nawaz Sharif, you know, should be, making the Taliban accountable, making the military accountable, and the military should make itself accountable, yes, to what has happened. And like I said, you know, this is something that has not happened in isolation. It has a much broader context, and it's time the citizens make the government and the military accountable to what has happened.
Shamim,
Bernie,
I
mean,
Abbas,
rather than talk about the Muslim Pakistan and the Hindu India and all that kind,
yes,
of thing, you know, they have to provide security in Pakistan.
Shamim, Bernie Abbas calling on the people to rise up against government duplicity and ineffectiveness on this. She's Associate Professor of Political Science and Gender Studies at SUNY Purchase, author of Pakistan's Blasphemy Laws, From Islamic Empires to the Taliban, and Jahangir Khatak, Senior Editor of Voices of New York at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much, Brian, for having me, and thanks for giving me your voice. Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, as the U.S. Justice Department considers civil rights charges in the Eric Garner case, we'll talk to the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, Paul Fishman. He identified unconstitutional use of force in the Newark Police Department this year. We'll see what he has to say about the Garner case and unconstitutional policing in general. Stay with us.